we are here to discuss the growth, and we have special guests, but is there any needs that you have as a community? We can write them down that we can answer at a later date. If there's just some information that you want to know, but you're here today and it isn't about this, you can let us know at the break, or we can write it up now, so we'll take care of needs, and it's kind of the parking lot to take care of those things for you, if you have any. So just let us know. Dr. Goyette can take your information. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce the three special guests and then turn it over. And the first one needs no introduction, Mr. Neil Fried. I am a little bit disappointed that our state economist did not bring us a bow tie today. Oh, he did! All right. So that's good news. Okay, and sitting next to him is, Eddie Hunsinger, who is our demographer for the state. And, of course, over here is Dr. Knapp from ICER. He's a researcher from UAA. Correct? Correct. All right. So there is growth in the Valley, and I'm not sure if you know it, but certainly you might have seen it because of the new roads and the new buildings and the new schools. But this year we predicted approximately 350 new students into our district. And 746 showed up. And so we're quite excited about that. We're not sure about if that trend is going to continue. And in front of you is a little bit of our own study about where the students were, and I can explain that later, but red dots decrease, green dots increase, bigger green dots is where they increase the most. Of course, this year we did open up a new junior senior high school, so that was the biggest increase because it went from zero to about 500 kids. But that's our individual information, but we're all here really today, staff at our building included, to hear our guests. So without further ado, let's give them a welcome and a round of applause. Thank you very much.
Good morning, everyone. Everyone hear me all right? All right, so I'm going to provide a sort of a broad demographic overview for today's discussion, so lots of context when we're thinking about the match student population, and then Neil will speak after me, and then Gunnar after Neil. So we'll start with total population for the match student borough. As of 2014, that's our latest estimate that came out last January, the population sat at 98,000 and change. That is very close to the 100,000 threshold. In recent years, the match student borough has been increasing by about 2,000 people a year. That's slower than we saw in the 2000s. So since 2010, it's been about 2,000 people per year. In the 2000s, the match student borough was increasing about 2,500 up to 4,000 people per year, very rapid growth. And it's still, even though it hasn't been as fast as it was back then, match student borough is far and away the fastest growing region of the state, or the fastest growing borough in the state. It's the one borough in the state that has positive and significant net migration predictably from year to year. These past few years, again, hasn't been quite as much net migration. It's been about 1,000 to 1,500 people net gains just through migration the last 4 or 5 years. Previous to that, it was about 1,500 to 3,000 people a year just through net migration. So there's a few components of change. You see, this total population, it just gives a very simple sort of picture of the match student borough population, but a lot is going on under below this. There are births going on, there's deaths going on, there's people moving to the match student borough, there's people moving from the match student borough, and everybody in the match student borough is getting older. And age relates very closely to things like deaths. Age relates closely to when you have children. Age relates closely to what age are you born? You're always born at age zero. And it also relates closely to migration. People move more at certain ages, very predictably. There's a big turnover each year. Even though we see especially on this big graph from year to year, looks like small changes from year to year, there's a lot more turnover going on beneath the surface. So the big question is, what will 2015 look like? Our 2015 estimate will come out in January. I don't expect any big surprises. I imagine there'll be growth. But my big question is, because we've been having about 2,000 people a year growth, will we cross the 100,000 threshold? I'd say 55-45 that I think it'll probably cross 100,000 this year. Things that I am very sure about. So we have a lot of things we talk about that we're unsure about, especially in these interesting economic times. But some things that I am very sure about are the ages that people will have children. People have children in their 20s and 30s. The ages that people will move the most. People move the most just after high school, right when they're going into their first job or college or so on. And then they move less as they get older. So 20s to 40s are really big migration ages. And then it dips down steadily. Older people, I know we hear a lot that, you know, we're going to have big increases in 65-plus population because they're going to move here. But most of that big increase in 65-plus population, far and away, is aging. It's not people moving. People move less. Even if you go to Boca Raton, Florida, people move less at higher ages. And that's true in Alaska. It's pretty predictable across the country the ages that people move the most at. And those are just after high school and in the early working years and then dipping with older ages. Young kids are moved more often than high school age kids. Maybe because their parents are not wanting to move them so much, but probably because their parents are younger when their kids are younger. So the things I'm pretty sure about for the math suit, these I'm pretty sure about still, are the ages of our biggest net gains and losses. So even if we have zero population change next year, we would still have age groups in the MACSUP world that gain population and age groups that lose population. It's been pretty steady for the MACSUP. The biggest gains happened in the 20s and 30s, and that there are a lot. And if there are any losses, there are minor losses in the higher ages, 60 plus. Where the movers will come from and go to, I'm pretty sure about. I'm pretty sure that those areas are going to be places like Anchorage, places that are big and or close. So Anchorage and out of state, we're thinking of Washington State, California, Texas, big states. Even if you go back a long time, it's pretty steady the places that send and receive the most people to Alaska, into and from the Maxwell world. Pretty sure about the thousands of people. No matter, even if things get very bad, I'm pretty sure thousands of people will still move to and from the MACSUP borough each year. So we have that 98,000 people, upwards of 7% of that population each year leaves. And upwards of 7%, something like, I think it's 8 to 10, maybe into 11% per year moves to the MACSUP borough in a single year. There's this constant turnover, this constant change. So even if we have big net migration losses, there are still a lot of people moving to the MACSUP world. I think for an example, for Alaska, in the 80s, things were very bad. From what, 87, was it 86, 87, were really tough years. So in those years, 30,000 people moved to Alaska. Even though we were in economic turmoil, there's still people moving to the state. The big story was bad, but there's a lot of smaller stories going on, people moving into their first job and so on. Job turnover, and people taking their first jobs and taking new jobs in life. So no matter what, I do expect there'll be sort of turnover of population. And the fourth thing I'm pretty sure about is that the MACSUP is going to get older. The median age will increase. The 65-plus population will increase in the future. So that's good. We have some certainty, right, about some things. So here are births and deaths for the MACSUP borough. You know, I probably can't see, but births have been about 1,300 people per year in the MACSUP borough. Deaths have been about 500 people per year. Deaths we expect to generally increase with aging of the population. Births could go either direction, frankly, because birth rates can change. The number of children per family can change over time. But we do have some idea of what births will look like just from the number of people in childbearing ages. In migration and out migration to the MACSUP borough. You can't see it very well, you can't see it, but I'll tell you, these numbers are a lot bigger than the births and deaths numbers. Nearly 10,000 people per year arrive in the MACSUP borough each year, nearly 10,000 people. And nearly 10,000 people leave the MACSUP borough. So people do leave the MACSUP borough, believe it or not, even though the gate we go to net migration means in general. These are just moves to and from Anchorage. So of that 10,000 or so, about 2,000 to 3,000 are to and from Anchorage. Actually, the last couple of years, we've seen increase in net migration gains from Anchorage. I'm expecting for 2015, we'll see this again, that we'll have another year of big increases net from people moving from Anchorage to Jackson. So here's looking at age groups. So looking at Massachusetts population by age, we can hear about the increasing 65 plus population. That's that top one in purple. The working ages are 20 to 60, or in green, 20 to 64, and the young ages here are 19 and below on the bottom. So we do see this increase in Massachusetts borough 65 plus population from the aging of Massachusetts current population largely. It's not as, I think it's about 10% right now. It's not as dramatic as some people think, but it will increase. But because the Massachusetts borough gains people at certain ages in their 20s and 40s, even though Massachusetts borough is having really significant growth in all of its population, including the 65 plus population, its share 65 plus still won't be as high as it will be in other parts of the state, like the Kenai Peninsula, and even Anchorage and Juneau for sure. We're still going to have a smaller share of 65 plus population than in the Massachusetts borough than we will in those other regions. Here's a graph, this next one. This shows Alaska's, the percent of population is 65 plus going back to 1980 all the way through 2035 on the right. Massachusetts borough is in green near the very bottom. Even though the Massachusetts will have some of the most rapid growth in the number of people age 65 plus, its percent 65 plus will still stay somewhat lower than most regions of the state, just because overall growth is, will be bigger. And a lot of those gains will be to ages 20 to 40 and so on, and for growth in children, number of children. Juneau is closer to the top. Anchorage is closer to the top. Kenai Peninsula is the highest there. So, real quickly, so this is the Massachusetts borough population by age and sex back in 2010. So I just wanted to give you an idea of what I'm seeing when I look at how population change will take place and what helps inform me of what the future will look like for the Massachusetts borough and for other regions of the state. So this is the Massachusetts population. Along the left axis there is population by age. On the left is males, on the right is females. So I see this and I see our components of change are births and deaths and migration. And I know that in the max, that the births will happen at the lowest age groups, and our fourth component of change is aging. So I know that our births will happen at the lowest age group, they'll be age zero. I know that deaths will subtract from the higher age groups. I know net migration, and this is steady going back decades for the Massachusetts borough now, that the net migration gains have been in those specific ages. We'll have gains for people in their 20s and 40s. We'll have potentially some losses at the higher ages. And I know that the entire pyramid, this population graph, will shift upward. So in 5 years, everybody who's age 50 will be 55. So if we go back to, this is 2010, if we go back to 1980, I see those shifts take place. We had big net migration gains in the 1980s. It overwhelmed sort of the other components of population change. We saw the population go from 1980 to 1990. This is pretty much what the net migration profile looks like for Massachusetts borough. Maybe a little bit more on with the more people in young ages, but if we were just to look at net migration gains by age, it would look like higher that big peak in the late 20s and into the 30s, and they would bring some young kids with them. So that's what happened to 1990. And then through 2000, we'll see them get older. Still, those big net migration gains that we see in the Massachusetts borough. Still, the expected increases in population from migration in the 20s to 40s. Then, through 2010, shift upward. You can see that population that's age 45 shifts upward to the 55 plus population, population. And also, that migration, those migration gains by age. And then, so this is our last graph through 2010. So, that's what I'm thinking of, that's what I'm seeing when. Pretty simple demography when I'm thinking about population change. And I know that we're going to see this continue no matter if we have a tough economic times. I know that we'll still have a large number of people moving to and from the Massachusetts borough, and then we'll have gains and losses at certain ages that are fairly predictable. So here I just wanted to point out the parts of the Massachusetts that are having the most growth are many of them along the Parks Highway in the western part of this sort of settled Matt Subaru. The Nick Fairview at the obvious one. Also, Quinn McKenzie at Big Growth, but that was related. That was the prison. I think about 1,200 of the 1,500 was the prison. Gateway and Lakes. Bishop. The balance up. So even though in Palmer we have very little growth, it's in the middle of the graph here. I think it might be around 100 people. Just outside of Palmer, there was significant growth. So why I say balance here, I mean all those areas just outside of the proper boundaries. But yeah, all to say, a lot of the growth has been along that Park 58 path. Here, I just wanted to point out, so I look at sort of the more refined data here. I wanted to point out this data set that we have before we go on. These are just the last couple of things I wanted to note. We have a data set now you can look at. With PFD applications, you can look at the people who move to and from each community in Alaska. So if you're from Lakes, if you're from Gateway, if you're from Palmer, you can look at the number of people who moved in from another place within the borough census area, the number of people who moved in from Anchorage. You can look at all these statistics each year. They're updated on our website to see the turnover for your community. So I'm going to point that out. These are the first migration into Wasilla. This is Wasilla. These are from, that's the migration out from Wasilla. So I just wanted to point these out for data users that it can be a really good resource for you. Because even though we're looking at the Madison borough level, there's so many more interesting dynamics going on below the borough or within the borough. Here's what that data set looks like. If you ever want to access it, every community in Alaska, we're very happy about this because we can really track, you know, what's going on a lot better now. We can report it a lot better now. So also, my last thing I wanted to point out, 2020 census, this is a very big deal and will be a bigger deal in coming years. I know it seems like a long way out, but the census is incredibly important for redistricting, of course, and also for funding information from, I'll read the quote from the Census Bureau, information the Census Bureau collects helps to determine how more than $400 billion of federal funding each year is spent on infrastructure and services. That's, I think over $1,000 a person for the U.S. And probably in Alaska, it probably could be a little bit more than that. So every person, that we need to make sure that we get good enumeration on every person. If you hear census programs coming up in the future, you'll know why they're so important to the media. Countless statistics go back to the decennial census. So that'll be something to have in mind in the future. I'm putting this in every presentation I did now. So that's my sort of broad demographic overview. Does anybody have any questions? Yes?
My name is Larry Gehrman, and I am the Vice Chair of the Mississippi State, the Vice Chair of the Coalition of Team. A few things. In 2025, I love to come to the Health Foundation work.
In 2025, one out of five people in our borough will be seniors. $3 billion a year is spent by seniors. They own a home. Their tax money helps our schools stay in business. The senior population is having more problems, and we are losing more than we expected. And here's the reason why. You are a senior, right there, not hard to find us. You have a medical problem. So you go to the stent, you need a artery transplant, whatever you need, it's cheaper. Fly to Seattle, stay at a hotel, they don't need to hire the Marriott, have your surgery, cheaper than you can have the surgery performed in the state of Alaska. We are going to lose, and all of these seniors in the medical. Seniors are withdrawers. All our lives were deposited, like all the young folks, into the system. As seniors, we are withdrawers. Our medical things start coming up, machinery starts breaking, and we take money out. But we are going to lose seniors. And when we lose seniors, we lose dollars for education. I knew nothing about education until my lovely wife got on the school board, and now I have a little bit of room to put it. So I see the coalition going up. This huge amount of seniors is somewhat for our schools.
Thank you. else have any questions? Feel free. You'd like to follow me here?
No.
Are you feeling more certain or less certain than I am about?
Demographic numbers that always look best. Employment numbers, no, they look actually pretty good. Many of you are familiar with these numbers. I just updated it for this year. And I come out here many times a year. This data's not going to look that different. I mean, I should be happy maybe that it's not going to look that different than what I reported last year. I'm going to move really fast because I want Gunnar to spend more time talking about the big picture. What is going to happen? I think what he has to say is really important and something we may have not heard it yet. So I'm going to move quickly. If you have questions while I'm racing through these slides, just please feel free to ask, not wait till the end. But I am going to move pretty quickly. This here is your employment, and you can see that upward trajectory is still there. Employment is still growing in the Matsuburo. And you can't take that, we've taken that for granted for over 20 years. I'm not sure we're going to be able to continue to take that for granted during the next 2 or 3 years. We've already begun to see other parts of the state slow down. Both Anchorage and the state is growing at less than 1% right now. And really has grown less than 1%. And I'm talking about employment here, not population, although that's probably true for population as well. And that's a different story than the Valley. Here's the Valley's employment growth. It's an estimate, but we have real numbers through the second quarter, so I doubt it's going to be any different, but you grew by about 3% in 2015. Pretty good. I mean, it's sort of close to the long-term average. Here's this is what I mean. This is the growth in the state right now. You can see the state's growing about 0.7%. We're lagging the rest of the country. You're not. You're still growing a little bit faster than the rest of the country, and I know that makes you feel really good. I'm not here to make you feel good. I don't like to make people feel good. That's not my job. That's not my profession. But that's what the numbers tell us. This is the absolute number. It looks like you'll grow by about 600 this year. That's 600 new jobs that physically exist in the Matsu Valley that are getting a paycheck. It doesn't include your self-employed. I think if your overall workforce is growing by about 3%, the number of self-employed is probably growing at a similar rate. This also, the reason why I wouldn't include the uniformed military is because they do not work here. Again, these are numbers of people that work that are physically working here in the Valley. Some of these people may be from Anchorage. This is just where the growth has been by industry. No big surprises, although this was the last year, and it changed from year to year. These numbers are really, for most part, small. Interestingly, healthcare declined a little bit last year. When I look at this year, I didn't put this year's numbers up yet because I like four quarters when I'm looking at this kind of detail. Because it can change. But again, no big surprise. I mean, social assistance, that's social services, information are things like our technology and communications, professional business services, all kinds of people, funeral parlors and engineering services. And I mean, it's a weird mixture. You can see nice construction, retail, bars and restaurants, leisure and hospitality, that's not hospitals, that's leisure and hospitality, that contributes to hospital activity, and then government. That's federal, state, local. Most of that's local. A lot of course, is tied to the growth of your school district, which is the largest single employer in the Valley. This here is just where the jobs are. No big change. If you've seen this before, it doesn't look much different than it did 3 or 4 years ago. Again, these are the physical jobs that exist here in the Valley. In other words, what this is saying is that 11% of the jobs that are here in the Valley are in healthcare. 10% of the people that live here, that work here, are entrepreneurs. They don't necessarily live here. Most of them do. But this just tells you sort of the breakdown of the jobs that exist, the opportunities that exist here physically in the Valley. And this is, you know, you've seen this before. I don't show this graph anywhere else because it's not significant in most other parts of the state, but here it is. This is where Valley residents work. And the really significant change here, and I'm going to talk a little bit about this more because it's going to sort of maybe tie a little bit into also what Gunnar talks about, but is this fairly sizable slice of Valley residents that work on the North Slope. Because that slice has changed a lot. This slice has not changed very much. I mean, it's increased in absolute numbers, but as a percentage, not a big deal. And you can see some of the other things as well. If the Kenai Peninsula knew that 1% of you were sneaking down there on a regular basis, they probably wouldn't be happy about it. This here is the people ask, the percent of Valley residents working in the Valley. Has that changed? Has that dynamic changed? And surprisingly, it has not. You know, if you had asked me 10 years ago, Neil, and I'm sure you probably did because I've been coming up here for more, I'm not going to say. But I would have said this probably would have gotten, this probably would have increased, and it hasn't. It's remained fairly, you know, the absolute numbers obviously have changed a lot, but the share of Valley residents that work here over time has changed very, very little. It's surprisingly boring, but that is actually a surprise that dynamic hasn't changed very much. And this has changed some, and I think that's sort of interesting, is that as a percent, commuting to Anchorage has declined. The red is the absolute numbers, and that's gone up some, but the percent has come down over time. But that the overall percent has obviously been made up by growth of commuters going somewhere else. That's sort of interesting. This, I think, is really sort of an amazing statistic here that's happened in the Valley. It's happened elsewhere, but it's been more dramatic here than anywhere else in the state as a percent and an absolute growth. This is the number of Matsu residents working on the slope over time. I don't have 14 yet. We don't have that data yet because we have to match it. I don't have 15 yet, but I can tell you this. 14 probably grew some, and maybe 15 grew some. I have the real numbers just for Prudhoe Bay. People working in Prudhoe Bay, it was a record number in the first quarter of 2015, the largest workforce ever in Prudhoe Bay. That might be true in the second quarter. I don't know if that'll be true in the third and fourth quarter. Yes.
I heard there was significant
layoffs. We are beginning to hear about layoffs on the slope, but it's very, very recent. I mean, it's so recent that we have not picked it up in the statistics yet. But yes, we are beginning to hear that. And I think we're going to hear a lot more of that in the next year or two. I think that's I think that gives some significance to these numbers. There is a vulnerability there, but you can see this incredible growth. I mean, 2005 was not that long ago, folks, and you can see that almost triple. And that had a big effect on that. You've seen this before. This explains why people commute. It's the earning power, the ability to earn more money somewhere else, and you can see why the slope is quite attractive. These are averages, they're dangerous, but they do tell a story. This is I thought was quite interesting. I was looking at median household income, and what's interesting is when you look at median earnings, let's go back here, you compare Anchorage to the Valley, or Anchorage to statewide. When you look at income, the difference isn't as great. And one of the reasons why the difference isn't as great is because that earning power of Matsu residents earning wages and earnings in other places. And one of those, of course, is the North Slope. The last time we were able to measure it, even though these numbers are not that big, they earn about, you know, when you look at total payroll, they bring home about 50% of all payroll that's earned in the Valley. So let's say the Valley earns about, there's about $50 million generating payroll here physically in the Valley. About $250 million is earned by Valley residents on the North Slope. And you can see how that really does boost income on the slope. But,
that's why you have
that good income. That's right. I mean, it's true. I mean, a lot of people choose here, obviously, they don't necessarily choose here for job opportunities. They choose to live here somewhere else for some other reason and work somewhere else. This is unemployment. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but we have seen a significant change in that. The unemployment rate is basically sort of stabilized. Part of it's because of what's happened elsewhere nationally. National unemployment rate has come way down, and it's affecting migration as well. And it's sort of a governor on our unemployment rate as well. This here, you know, just tells you, again, this sort of sets the Mat-Su Valley apart. More people that live here, or more of the jobs that exist in the Valley are held by local residents compared to most other places. But, you know, Fairbanks isn't that far away, and neither is Anchorage. Let's forget about that one. You know, this is where that big difference is that I was talking about. Again, no big change. I just thought it was interesting to look at it compared to other places in the state. This, you know, I update this every year. We don't have 15 numbers yet, but this is a statistic that always confounds me. It's amazing that, you know, about 13% of the population of the state lives in the Valley, but you are building 33% of all new homes. Like in 2014, a third of all new homes built in the state were built here in the Mat-Su Valley. Here's home construction, building permit activity. The latest we have is for 2014. Because you have a special way to come up with permits. Usually there's a delay in how many buildings or how many new housing units were built in the Valley. I don't know what 2015 is going to look like for the Valley. My guess is it might increase. In Anchorage, in 2015, it actually decreased. We built fewer single-family homes, fewer duplexes, and fewer multifamily homes in Anchorage this last year. But you may look different, and I wouldn't be surprised. You know, here's your one of your big competitive advantages. You've seen this before. You know, I don't have to tell you about this. You know this quite well as we jealously look at this affordable housing. Here's sales, and this is through 14. And you can see that your sales continue to increase. Ours dropped off a little in 2014, but our sales went back up in 15 in Anchorage. Home sales is up. Home construction is down in Anchorage, but home sales is up just like here in the Mat-Su Valley. And Jerry here can, I think, review this data through the third quarter. Was it still up through the third quarter, Jerry?
Yeah, we were up 11% in terms of numbers of homes, or 19% in terms of volume.
So, you know, we're all looking for these indicators out there. Everyone's wondering, as economic stress showed up in our numbers yet? Like this gentleman said, he's heard about layoffs on the North Slope. I think it is beginning to happen. I think we'll have bigger layoffs next year. Connor will be talking about our big fiscal challenges that are already beginning to manifest themselves. The number of state jobs was -100 in January compared to a year ago. It's now 1,300 below a year ago, so that number's increasing. I think that number will increase again next year, maybe even more dramatically. But most of it's not manifesting itself in the numbers yet. That doesn't mean that this year is a roadmap to next year. You know, in most previous years in the last 20 years, the previous year was a very good indicator of what's going to happen next year. I don't know if that's going to be true in 2016, but I'll let Gunnar answer that one. I'm not putting a lot of weight on his shoulders. Does anyone know? Let's just go keep going. You love this number, I know that. It is amazing. I don't have 15 numbers left, so I shouldn't have it on there. With yet strong growth that you had in 2015. And this is, you still remain very weird up here. I have to say that. You are the only place where the number of register pickups continues to decline. I understood the previous new year. I don't know why that happened again in 2014. But that's very odd. We may have cheated for 2 years in Anchorage, but I don't see why we would have cheated for 3 years, because we haven't had IM tests for that long now. And our number of pickups have increased dramatically in the last couple of years, and sales statewide have been very, very good. So there's something going on here. A major cultural I don't know what's happening about it. But any questions? Yes.
First, we're very good
at
keeping our tax
rating
for a long time. So
that's the reason.
I wanted to ask you about permits and new homes. We're pretty notorious for building homes without permits.
And I shouldn't use the term building permit. That's why I can tell you how many new homes were built in Anchorage through October of this year, because we have building permits. I know some of your communities do, the appropriate communities do. But most home construction occurs outside of the borough, of those community boundaries, Palmer, Houston, or Wasilla. So we don't get those numbers, and we get those numbers from the assessor's office sometime in the next following year.
So it's just the ones that
building permits
found.
The wrong term. Pardon?
It's the ones the assessor has found.
Yes.
So it's really.
And I know we find it's very, satellites and drones that you can't get away from it anymore. Any other questions? Okay, yes.
Of the 56% employed in the Valley, that means 44% are working elsewhere.
That's correct.
What concerns me with the high number of people working in Anchorage, that means that income, 44% of their income isn't
way more than 44%.
Not spending their money in the Valley.
Oh, no, no,
no,
no, no. They're free. In fact, you're stealing that money from where I live and spending it here. So, no, it's sort of the opposite. The Madison Valley is one of the few places, there may be one other place in Alaska where there's a net increase in income coming from outside, from elsewhere in the state. Most parts of the state are losing income. Usually to somewhere else in the country, you have a net inflow of income. So it's very different, actually. Okay, well, let me turn this over to Gunnar.
So hi folks, my name is Gunnar Knapp. I'm director and professor of economics at the University of Alaska Anchorage Institute of Social and Economic Research, otherwise known as ICER. And I'm gonna try something pretty difficult today. I'm gonna try to combine talking about the fiscal situation the state of Alaska's in with what does that imply for the economy? And I've been actually spending a lot of time over the past year going around talking about the state's fiscal situation and the problem we have with our enormous deficit and the very difficult challenges that the legislature and governor face in trying to deal with that. But it is a sort of, and I'm going to talk about that, and by the way, that's what this presentation that I have here is about. It's about that fiscal situation. But I think that what a lot of people are interested in is the broader question that comes, well, what about the economic implications of that fiscal situation? In other words, what is this fiscal situation that we're in going to mean for our state's economy and for your economy out here? And so I can speculate about it, but I certainly don't claim to have a definitive answer. I want to start by saying that from my perspective, the economic outlook for our state's economy at the moment, sort of looking in the next 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, is highly uncertain. There's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of things that we don't know what's going to happen, and it sort of could go either way with different implications. And so, what are some of those things that we're uncertain about? Well, one is what's the federal government going to do with base closures or non-base closures? Sort of how much might the federal government's sort of military activity in Alaska change? And it might be significant or it might not. And a lot of that's politics, and it probably plays into sort of how the national election plays out and so on. So we don't, the federal government's a very big part of our economy. And so that's something we're uncertain about. Another thing that we're uncertain about is where is the oil industry going, the North Slope oil industry. We have these low oil prices. And in other parts of the country, over in Canada, these low oil prices have really devastated the oil industry. It resulted in huge cutbacks in oil employment, drilling, and so on. Not yet in Alaska. It's not yet showing up in the department's data. But with the notable exception of this disappointing pullout by Shell, and sort of saying, "Well, we're not going to go forward with this very ambitious plan they had for drilling in the Chukchi." But other than that, we haven't seen yet sort of big slowdowns or big cancellations of projects or so on. In fact, we've seen, as Neil was saying, at the beginning of this year, despite these low oil prices, this sort of amazing phenomenon of record oil industry employment. But how long will that go on at these low oil prices? We don't know, and there's a lot of uncertainty in the oil industry, and there's a lot of rumors circulating around. And what will happen depends a lot on what will happen to oil prices. That's another area of uncertainty. There's uncertainty in the mining industry, which is mining prices are, a lot of mineral prices are low for the same reasons that oil prices are low, and that sort of makes it difficult to invest in and develop a new mine. The fishing industry, salmon industries have seen a downturn. How long might that last? That's uncertain. We have had, and I'll show you some graphs about this in a little bit, we have had a very, very significant drop in the state's capital budget. From a capital budget of $2 billion several years ago down to just $100 million this year. But a lot of that money from those past capital budgets is still in the pipeline being spent. And so we haven't yet experienced the full economic impacts of that decline in capital spending. But we know that it's going to be coming fairly soon. We're going to see less state capital dollars finally flowing out and reaching the economy. We don't know what the effect of that will be. But added to all this other economic uncertainty is the economic uncertainty associated with our state's fiscal situation. And the very, very difficult circumstance we have with this enormous deficit and the question of how is the state going to respond to this, and how is that response going to affect the economy? And that's very, well, first of all, the response is very uncertain. probably if you're following the sort of politics of fiscal discussion, you can hear some very differing opinions about, you know, how we should respond and what we ought to do. And depending upon which response we take, sort of how the economy would be affected, when the economy would be affected, where in Alaska the economy would be affected, you get a different effect. So, but we can't, you know, it's difficult to predict the politics of this. And finally, the economy is very much influenced by investment and investor confidence. And so, you know, whether people want to build a house or invest in a new business and so on is partly driven by what they think is going to happen. And is it going to be a favorable investment climate? You know, will the investment pay off? If so, then they invest, and that sort of makes it a self-fulfilling prophecy. On the other hand, if they think things look bad, then they decide not to build the house and not to invest. And you can get a self-fulfilling negative effect. And so so the economy is affected by how our response to the fiscal situation affects people's expectations and confidence going forward. So that's a lot of uncertainty wrapped up all together. I guess I'll, before I go into this presentation about the fiscal situation, I guess the way I would summarize this uncertainty at the moment is that we are probably already in or entering in to at least a mild recession. Okay. What's driving that is things such as decline in federal spending decline in the state's capital budget and so on. This is already here or coming. But the how we respond to this fiscal situation has the potential to either aggravate this recession we're going into and make it worse, or maybe make it not so bad. Oh, by the way, I left off from my list the most uncertain, most important thing of all, sort of looking forward a little further, this Alaska LNG project. Will it happen or will it not happen? If it happens, it will be a very big economic shot in the arm in terms of generating employment, construction, and so on. But it is by no means certain that it's going to happen because of the sort of very uncertain situation with the world LNG market and the sheer cost of that project and sort of challenges, political challenges, economic challenges, and getting that going. So it very well could happen, but it is by no means absolute certain. So that's a huge project that might or might not happen. So plenty of uncertainty. I guess I summarized kind of where I think that we're going. We're going into a recession, but we don't know how severe it may or may not be. This presentation I'm about to show you, and my time's a little short, so I'm going to rush through parts of it, is a presentation I've been kind of giving around the state. And it is my attempt to summarize this very, very complicated and difficult fiscal challenge that we have basically for people who maybe started at ground zero and don't really understand very much about this. So some of you probably are very, very familiar with this already. Some of you, on the other hand, may not know so much. So I'm going to, but that's what this is. And so I'm sort of starting with kind of the basics of this issue, and then I'm going to sort of go in and talk in more detail. I do want to emphasize that I am, my goal in this presentation is to kind of outline the situation we're in. My goal is not here to, and sort of explain the facts and the choices we're confronted with. I am not here to advocate any particular way we ought to go in dealing with this. I think, reasonable people can have very different opinions about what we ought to do, but the starting point has to be an understanding of the basic facts. And here's the basic fact. We face an extremely serious fiscal challenge in Alaska. I don't think that most Alaskans recognize how very, very serious
this challenge is. And the challenge is that we are spending more than twice as much as our revenues. And we are paying for this deficit by drawing down our savings. This year we're spending, this year, fiscal year 16, we're spending $5.2 billion. And how are we paying for that? Well, $1.6 billion is from oil revenues, $565 million is from other kinds of miscellaneous state revenues, fish taxes, mining taxes, alcohol taxes, and $2.9 billion is by drawing down our savings. And the problem is we can't keep on paying for more than half of state government from our savings because we don't have unlimited savings. We have a lot of savings. We have $7.6 billion in savings that we're projected to have going into next fiscal year. But at the rate we're spending from our savings this year, that rate of draw would quickly eliminate those savings in just over 2 years. And that means that in the next few years, we're going to have to close this funding gap between our spending and revenues, because we don't have the savings for more than a few years to keep running that kind of deficit. And that means we're going to have to make very big changes in what we spend or how we pay for it, or both. We're going to have to make big changes in our spending or our revenues or both, and whatever we do to address this deficit is going to have implications for the economy. So the choices we face are, how are we going to fill this funding gap, and when are we going to fill this funding gap? Now, the only significant and practical options we have are some combination of spending cuts, new revenues, or using permanent fund earnings. That's the only. Yes, sir.
The state of Alaska has a little over $50 billion saved in the fund.
Yes, it does. Yeah, and so one of the options is using permanent fund earnings. As I'll explain in a second, in that permanent fund, and it's not $60 billion, it's about $2 billion. In any case, about $47 billion of that is the permanent fund principal, which cannot be spent. Can't spend it. But we have about $7 billion in earnings saved up that we could spend. And then we get new earnings every year, which we mostly use for dividends. And so, you know, that's money that we could use, not a popular choice. So what we face is kind of unpleasant options, cutting spending, raising taxes or new kinds of revenues or using fund earnings. So what are the questions? What combination of those things are we going to do? But the other question is, when are we going to do it? Now, we have enough savings saved up to put off the hard choices for 1 or 2 years. But there's a problem with delaying. There's a problem with going through another year, much less 2 years, and delaying making these choices. And the problem is, partly, if you sort of go through another huge deficit and draw down those savings, then you run the risk that you're going to sort of completely drain your savings and be forced to make very drastic changes all at once. But another problem which affects the economy is that it affects investor confidence if people are uncertain what you're going to do. Sir?
Bring your mic up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
There we go.
It affects investor confidence if people don't know how we're going to solve this problem. And so on the one hand, if we act now and we say, we'll cut spending and we'll have taxes and we'll use people's dividends or so on, well, that's going to affect the economy, right? That's going to have a negative effect on the economy, any of those things. On the other hand, if we don't do something, it's also going to have a negative effect on the economy because investors are going to say, those guys can't get their fiscal act together, and who knows where the economy is going to go in the future or what the outlook is. It affects our credit rating.
whether we are able to deal with this. Also, if we use up our savings, it affects the potential investment earnings from those savings. If we, when think of it, when we draw down our savings this year by more than $3 billion, that is a huge amount of potential future investment earnings foregone by losing those investments. Now, it's not just me saying that it affects our credit rating. Here is a report that came out in August, issued by Standard & Poor's, one of the big bond rating agencies. And they said they took a very unusual step. Let's see, this is a pointer here. There's a pointer. They took a very unusual step of saying, okay, Alaska, we're rating your bonds AAA, which is good or great, but we're rating the outlook for your bonds as negative. We're rating how we think the outlook for these bonds in the future as negative. And why did they revise the outlook to negative? The negative outlook reflects the large structural deficit in the state's unrestricted general fund, which could render its overall fiscal position inconsistent with the AAA rating. If lawmakers do not enact significant fiscal reforms to address the balance within the next year, the state's rating could begin transitioning down. Basically, what they said is, if you guys don't get your act together and show that you can get a handle on your fiscal situation, within the next year, we're going to tell people we no longer think you're such a good credit risk. Okay, now what I want to do is give you a few more details beyond what I've just been summarizing, so that you sort of get a general more of the background of this. And to that, for these details, you need to understand the way our state's revenues and spending, what they actually look like. Now, this is what most states' revenues and spending look like. It's pretty simple. They don't have oil revenues, they just have non-oil revenues, and typically those non-oil revenues are income taxes and sales taxes. And those non-oil revenues fall into a general fund, which pays for government spending. And they will typically have a kind of savings fund, but it'll be pretty small. It'll be definitely less than one year's budget. But here's our Alaska revenues and savings flows, and there are some significant differences. What are the significant differences? One is we have oil revenues. We've got quite significant oil taxes and oil royalties. Second, we've got a large savings fund called the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. And third, we've got a permanent fund. And these things make us quite different from other states. Now, in this graph, the width of the arrows, or the size of the arrows, represents what is the actual spending flow this year. Okay, and the government spending this year, you can see more is coming from the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund than from the general fund. That's definitely unusual. By the way, I see some of you taking pictures of this. You're welcome to, if you just give me your email address after the presentation, I'll let you know this presentation so you can have it. So what's our situation? Our situation is that in the past, we have been extremely dependent on oil revenues to fund our state government. And from 2005 to 2014, oil was paying for 90% of general fund spending. 90%. The basic problem that we face, this is sort of beyond our immediate fiscal situation, is that North Slope production has been declining for more than 25 years, and we're now at one quarter of the production we had at its peak, and meanwhile, our population's been rising. So you can't indefinitely go on paying for almost all of state government from oil revenues when the oil production is declining and the population is growing. At some point, it's going to catch up with us, and it's caught up with us right now in a big way because not only did the oil production fall, but the oil prices have fallen drastically, as we're about to see. Now, the state revenues are extremely sensitive to oil prices. extremely, so a change in oil prices has a very significant effect on our oil revenues. But that something most people don't get is that that is particularly so at prices above $80 a barrel. So this graph shows, here's $60 a barrel. At $60, we get about $2 billion in state revenues. At $130, we would get about $7 billion in state revenues. But there's this kink around 80. And the reason I'm making a big deal of this is at the moment, the price of oil is around $45 a barrel. So our oil revenues are really low. Now, you might read in the paper sometimes, well, look, the price of oil went up. It went up by a dollar. It went up by $10. It went up to 50. It went up to 60. It went up even to 70. But until the price starts going above 80, we don't start going back to the good old days when we had lots of oil money. Until the price gets up above 80, we're not going to start getting large amounts of oil money. And the bad news is, the price is probably not going to go up above 80, or at least not very much. So here we are, 90% dependent on oil revenues. Oil revenues extremely sensitive to oil prices. And then what happens? A year and a half ago, the price of oil just crashed and fell by more than half. So we had this drastic drop in oil prices. And that led to this huge drop in our oil revenues. Our oil revenues have fallen by $7.2 billion from 2012 to 2015. That's an 81% drop. Our oil revenues had been rising until 2012 because oil prices were rising. And then after 2012, they have fallen drastically. Now, you might say, well, the oil prices fell in this period, but actually the oil prices had some real spikes in this 2012 year that led to, because of the progressivity, led to really high revenues in 2012. And then oil prices have also fallen because deductible costs of oil production have reduced what the production tax could collect. Some people think that this fall in oil revenues was driven by the oil tax change from ESAs to SB 21. That's a complicated story, but basically, no, that's not why our oil revenues have fallen. If oil prices were way up over $100, then yeah, we'd be earning more with the ESAs tax than the SB 21. But down here at these terrible low prices we have now, that's not the reason our oil prices are low. The reason our oil prices, our oil revenues are low is because the price is drastically lower and the profits are drastically lower and there's nothing left to pack. So here's the basic problem. In just 3 years, most of the money we've been using to pay for state government evaporated. It's just gone. And that's why we have a big problem. Now, from 2005 to 2012, we were, this is a complicated graph. It's worth studying, though. This top line, the red line, shows the revenues that I was just showing you. And this blue line shows the state spending. What basically happened is, as the revenues were rising, so was the state spending. We said, as the revenues went up, we said, wow, we're rich. Now let's spend more. And then the next year, higher revenues. We're richer. Let's spend even more. But we didn't spend all of it. We saved a lot of it. We ran big surpluses, even though we were spending more, because our revenues were going up so much. But then we had this drastic fall in revenues, and we went from big surpluses to big deficits. And we're luckily, before 2013, we saved surpluses in the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund and some other funds, and that's what allows us now to be paying for government more than half of it out of this Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. Here's the picture of what happened. The Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund was growing, 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 and also another fund called the Statutory Budget Reserve Fund.
And now that we've been running the big deficits, these funds have been dropping, dropping, dropping. Sir?
In your fly back in the deficit numbers for 15, is that based on $69 a barrel or $45?
This, unfortunately, is based on the optimistic assumption of $66 a barrel. So actually, this deficit, these revenues are not going to be here, they're going to be lower, and the deficit is going to be bigger. I think several hundred million, it's several hundred million dollars worse than this cheerful graph here. I don't think most people have a grasp of how huge the deficit is. This is my way of trying to explain it. He goes, it's a $3 billion deficit. That's the optimistic version. It's actually a bigger deficit than we mentioned. We're not going to get $2.2 billion. I'll talk about that in a bit. But here's a way you can think of how big a deficit, how big is $3.0 billion. We are spending $7,100 per Alaskan. Optimistically, we'll take in $3,000 per Alaskan. That means the deficit is $4,100 per Alaskan. So if you thought, my wife says, well, I remember in the old days, when you started a job, they took $100 out of your paycheck. And and that was the school tax. So we should put back the school tax with my wife, and that way we can solve the deficit. But $100, I mean, that'd be a nice start, $100 per Alaskan. But we have $4,100 per Alaskan deficit. Another way you could think, get your hand around this, that's twice the size of our permanent fund. So if you completely gave up the permanent fund and said, okay, I give up my permanent fund to help pay for government, that would solve half the problem. So it's a really big problem. And as this gentleman here was just alluding to, unfortunately, the projection of how much money we're likely to have this year is based on the what is clearly an over-optimistic assumption that prices this year will average $66 a barrel, when in fact they're sitting down here around $45 a barrel. Now here's a big question. Aren't oil prices going to come back up and save us? And so we can hope for that. I hope for that. And in fact, oil prices in the past always have come back up and saved us. And that's what happened about 15 years ago when we were in what to economists like me felt like a situation like this, and we thought, oh, we're doomed, the sky's going to fall, and we told everybody we're doomed, the sky's going to fall, we got to mend our ways, stop sinning. But we prayed for one more oil boom, we weren't going to blow it this time, and we got it. The price came back, and we had those huge new expenditures. But it's possible oil prices could go up to $100, $150. You can think of scenarios that would cause that. If a wonderful thing happened and, Saudi Arabia had a revolution, or Iran, Pakistan, but probably something wonderful like that won't happen, and probably oil prices are not going to go back up above the $70 and $90 range. Certainly.
Sorry.
I have a simplistic question about economics 101. I'm not a real learner, but spending more than you earn is a disaster. Starting with our state, going right up to the government for our whole country, it seems to be an outlook. And the price of oil is indicated by supply and demand. And there are major reasons for foreign countries to want to flood the market with oil and drive it down. It's killing us and it's destroying Russia. This is not going to stop. Why does anyone think it will? This is a program that's premeditated to do just what it's doing. Where is the sunny spot in the sky? Is there one?
Well, of course there is. And just talk to Neil. He is I guess what I would say is, for the reason you mentioned, which a lot of people suggest, and basically the fact that the world can produce a ton of oil profitably at prices in the $70 to $90 range, it seems pretty unlikely we're going to go back to prices above that range. It seems pretty unlikely we're going to go back to the prices that made us rich. And even if we did, over the longer term, if our oil production keeps falling, our revenues would still fall. So hoping that oil prices rise is neither realistic nor responsible as a way of dealing with this. And by the way, this graph I showed you before, but here's how much money we'd get if prices go up to $90 a barrel from 45. And here's how much money we'd get if they went up to just 70. And we still have a great big deficit. Okay, now let's look at the spending side of it. Where are we spending this $5.2 billion? And this is all the places that this $5.2 billion is going to. And now I want to start trying to make this directly relevant to you guys. The biggest single part of the state budget is education. Okay, and almost all of that is the K-12 formula funding program, which funds K-12 schools in the state. And I heard Neil say that the school district in Mat-Su is your biggest employer. Okay, and there's 2,200 jobs associated with the school district. And the fact is, if you think, and a lot of people say, if you think we gotta cut government, and government's bloated and government spends too much, if you think that and you look around, well, where's the money going? One large, very large chunk of that is government. And of course, people don't like to cut education. So one large part of that is education, very large part. And a lot of people don't want to cut education. But if you're looking for money, this is where a lot of the money is. So this is one of the major political tensions in this state. If we cut spending, how much might we cut out of education? And that would definitely affect affect people everywhere, but it would affect, in particular, a place like this where you've got a large school-age population and a large school district. The second largest part of the budget is health and social services. Okay, and about half of this is the, a little over half is the Medicaid formula funding that pays for health care for poor people in Alaska. But this also funds children's services and a variety of other social services. This is difficult to cut. And then all these other agencies, the university, corrections, transportation, all this are about $1.5 billion combined. So the point is that it's in education and health is, a very significant part of any significant cuts would have to come out of those. Although there's obviously real money in the university correction and so on. We got $500 million in oil tax credits that the state is paying. And I would, I'm no political analyst, but I would guess that these are politically vulnerable in a time where there's a lot of pressure on the budget. And then here's debt service and retirement, and that really can't be cut. Those are basically legal obligations or near legal obligations with them, and so on. And then we have this tiny capital budget of only $118 million. Here, it's hard to see, but the capital budget's up here in this purple on top. It's hard to distinguish between the brown oil tax credits. But the legislature has cut a tremendous amount from the budget over the past several years, but most of those cuts have been in the capital spending, down from $2 billion to just $100 million. And the problem is, if you say, well, we gotta cut more, there's no capital spending left to cut. So new cuts will come out of, if we're gonna have new cuts, they gotta have to come out of either the oil tax credits or the agency. And if they cut out of state agencies, that will have economic implications wherever those state agencies are, in terms of the workers, in terms of the workers' income, or in terms of the contractors, where, to the extent that the state's paying for contractors. Now, to sort of the last part of the picture that you need to understand is the permanent fund, and most people don't really understand the permanent fund because it's very, very complicated. And so let's take a quick tour of the permanent fund, how it works. The permanent fund was originally built up over more than 35 years from oil royalties. A share of the state's oil royalties go by, under the Constitution, they go into the permanent fund principal, and they can't be spent. And this permanent fund principal has now been built up to $47 billion over years and years of contribution. Just like they say, when you're young, you know, you start your first job, put some money in a retirement account. You know, keep putting it in every year, and, you know, 35 years goes by, and you'll have $47 billion. Okay. Now, we've also added to that by putting in some special appropriations, also what's called inflation proof. But then the permanent fund has earnings, and the so-called realized earnings of the permanent fund were about $2.7 billion this year, and those go into an earnings reserve, which is about $7.6 billion, and that may be spent. And what do we spend it on? Well, we take some and put it as inflation proofing in principle, and we spend some on dividend, about $1.4 billion this year. So this graph shows over time the way the principal has grown and the way the earnings reserve has grown. So that's a substantial chunk of money in that earnings reserve. And the legislature can go in and appropriate from that if they wish. Although they have been very reluctant to do so, because if you hear the words legislature spends and permanent fund in the same phrase, you know, then the lynch mobs start to form. The last legislation that tried that, every single one of them got lynched. did that really happen? I guess not. Okay. Now, the permanent fund has been earning billions of dollars in recent years, but you can see that these earnings are pretty variable. Okay? And there's no guarantee that you'll earn money. We lost a lot of money in 2009 in the great financial crash. But and then what do we use that money for? Dividends and inflation proofing. And this is over time what we spent on dividends and what we spent on inflation proofing. And this is a very, very complicated graph. I'm really proud of it. It's my proudest achievement of my career. It actually combines the two previous graphs, and there's a point I'm going to make. This top line shows what the earnings are each year, as they have been, and under here you see what we spent on dividends, and you see what we spent on inflation proofing, back in the principal. And you see, we've been earning more than we've been using for dividends and inflation proofing. There's been this amount left over, and that has been redeposited in the earnings reserve, so the earnings reserve has been growing. And finally, about the permanent fund, the earnings are more than our oil revenue. The earnings are more than our oil revenue. So this is I think, something a lot of people haven't psychologically grasped. We now get more money as a state from the investments of this permanent fund around the world in stocks and real estate and so on than we get from our oil industry up on North Slope. So this makes it, in my mind, really a little ridiculous when people say, well, we got a fiscal problem in the state of Alaska, and some people say, well, the permanent fund is not, whatever we do, the permanent fund is not going to be part of how we address it. Well, this is like more than half our earnings. It's, in some way, it will become part of how we address this. So, I think that we need a basic reality check on our options. How can we fix this funding gap? Well, it's going to be very hard to say we can fix it all by cutting spending, because the deficit is more than half our spending. So if you're going to fix this by cutting spending, you would have to cut more than half of what state government spends. Then you could say, well, could we raise new revenues? And well, yeah, we could. But how much could we raise? Well, here's just some estimates of things that could be done. You could have an income tax and a 15% of, if you had an income tax, for example, it was 15% of your federal tax obligation, Department of Revenue estimated, well, that would raise about $650 million. Or a statewide sales tax could raise about $400 million. Or various kinds of realistic possible changes to oil taxes could raise you maybe $500 million. But there's a lot of suggestions people have that aren't going to raise you that money. For example, people talk about a marijuana tax. You know, marijuana is legal, now we're going to have a giant marijuana industry, we can tax it, and we'll all get rich, we don't have a fiscal problem. But the estimates that are out there about what could a marijuana tax raise, around $20 million. But our deficit is $4,000 million. Right, $3,000 million. So $20 million would help, but it's not $3,000 million. Yes?
And what your slide doesn't address there is that each one of those comes from different people. For instance, income tax, 15% of it would come from non-Alaskans. It also doesn't address the economic impact of each one of those because
No.
It does affect a very different population.
It's true. This slide doesn't say anything. All this slide says is... In fact, this speaker doesn't say anything. But all this slide shows is how much money you could get. But if you care, as all of us do, about the economy, and as if you care about sort of who ends up paying, these are very different kinds of things. An income tax, who does that affect? That affects wealthier people who would have to pay a much larger amount than a lot of households wouldn't pay anything. Sales tax would affect everybody, but it would be not particularly good for places like, you know, the Valley, where you got a lot of jurisdictions with sales taxes, and a statewide sales tax on top of that would be an awkward thing. Fishing tax, you could have, but fishermen probably wouldn't like that. So different people can be affected in different ways if you do these things. All of these things would affect the economy if they take money out of the economy.
Well, and you can go on.
I can go on, but tell you what, how about if I go 5 minutes without something? I will point out, and because a lot of I think it needs to be, we need to understand, if you talk about taxing Alaskans, in terms of taxes we pay to the state, as a broad base, we are not suffering in terms of the taxes pay the state. We pay far less in taxes than citizens of any other state on a per capita basis. Every other state has either a sales tax or an income tax, statewide sales tax or statewide income tax. And a lot of states have both. We have neither. I don't know why that's relevant to anything, but given the difficulty of closing this gap, there's a lot of interest in using permanent fund earnings. And there's a lot of talk about it because the amount of money that permanent fund is spinning off is significant. Dividends, what we're spending on dividends represents half of the projected deficit. And then there's amounts the permanent fund is earning over and above that, which could go, for example, to the deficit. And then there's a lot in the earnings reserve. And so you are undoubtedly going to hear a lot of talk about using the earnings. And there's a lot of proposals out there to use permanent fund earnings. And expect to hear a lot of talk about this. One that will probably get a considerable amount of talk, at least, is the Walker administration's proposal from a couple weeks ago called the Sovereign Wealth Fund proposal. And that one is really complicated. It looks like this,
they are proposing that dividends would no longer come from the permanent fund, but rather would come from oil royalties, and all the oil revenues, other than those going for dividends, would go into the permanent fund, and then the permanent fund earnings would go to the general fund. So this is the kind of proposal that is out there being discussed, but there's going to be a lot of other proposals of that sort. I guess I'm going to leave it as far as my slides with one last thing. Our fiscal options are really not so terrible compared with other states, considering that most other states don't have any oil revenues or any permanent fund, and which is why they spend a lot less for government. They have income taxes or sales taxes, and they don't pay dividends. And so we're sort of faced with this unpleasant choice of spending less, paying taxes, paying smaller dividends. But now I want to take a couple minutes and say, how does all this relate to the economy? So we sort of have four, actually five options going forward about what we can do.
Here's how? They're done. Oh, okay.
We have this very significant fiscal problem. So one thing we can do is delay. We can say, this is what I call the Scarlett O'Hara approach. Well, I won't think about it today, I'll think about it tomorrow. Or I think about it after the election, okay? And so the advantage of that, if we delay, we avoid inflicting any pain on the economy this year by cutting spending or taxing or so on. But it risks investor confidence, and it risks investment, and it hurts our bond rating. Okay, so there's this trade-off between sort of when are we going to deal with this? This sort of, when do we take the pain, sooner or later? Second thing is, any of these things that you do, there's only one thing you can do that doesn't inflict pain on the economy. If you cut spending, that inflicts pain on the economy, right? What is it? Say you say, okay, let's save some money, let's eliminate the Mansu school district, okay? That inflicts pain on the economy in a number of ways. It takes a lot of jobs out of the economy, it takes a lot of income out of the economy, and it makes the Mansu district, now that it no longer has any schools, not as pleasant a place to live. So everybody leaves, right? Because you reduce the quality of public services. So cutting spending in various ways obviously has pretty big effects on the economy. To say, okay, we don't want to cut spending that hurt the economy. Well, so let's have taxes. Well, if you tax people, that's going to take away their income, and they're going to spend less, and that's going to hurt the entire retail sector and so on, and they just have less money affects the economy. And furthermore, if they begin to feel really overtaxed, they may say, you know, it was actually more fun living in Washington State or Oregon or wherever I came from, and so a lot of people may leave. So taxes aren't so good either. You can say, well, we'll tax the oil industry. You try to tax the oil industry, they say, well, you know, you guys don't look as good a place to invest. So maybe we're going to have less oil production in the future. So that's not so good. You say, well, okay, look at that big juicy dividend. We'll take away some of that dividend to help pay for state government, but that's going to affect people's spending directly because that's very much a part of spendable household income. And that money, when people get those dividend checks, they a lot of that gets spent in the economy. That's very important to the retail and services sector. And somehow, and there's the answer to your pickup truck question. But here's the one thing you can do that doesn't affect the economy, and that is to spend permanent fund earnings, those permanent fund earnings that are, spend permanent fund earnings doesn't affect the economy. It doesn't hurt the economy. If you spend permanent fund earnings, it is injecting money out into the economy without taking it from somewhere else. What does it hurt? It hurts, it reduce, if I'm talking about spending permanent fund earnings without cutting dividends. Okay? If you do that, then you are keeping spending flows going into the economy without taking it out of some other part of the economy. In effect, if we stop growing the permanent fund and start spending in the economy, then that has less of an effect. But there's only a limited capacity to do that. So these are the difficult choices we face. They're difficult choices in a fiscal sense. They're difficult choices in a political sense, and in terms of what are your values. And they're difficult in an economic sense because the choices we make are going to affect the economy in different ways. And I'm sorry if I kind of overstayed my time and rushed through this, and yet we barely touched on it. There's a lot more details to this than I could possibly go through in a short time. But I think this is the reality that we're in, and this is expect to hear a lot more about this question in this legislative session going forward. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I want to thank all three gentlemen, and it was quite a lot of data, and personally, I really got amped about this. My training is as a psychometrician, so I like data, and to my staff, noticing that you put down the mic and picked up that, now you understand my behaviors. I love this stuff. I do the same stuff, so I love this nerdy stuff. So if you would like to stay, we can answer questions, and I do just want to put in a plug that our borough hired ICER about 3 years ago for a land study on the use of their lands, and of course the school district being a good portion. Our borough pays 24% of our total cost of our school district. The federal government is 1%, and the state is 74%. And in that ICER report, it did say that your Matsu Borough School District is the most efficient school district in Alaska. So I just want to let you know that, and to those audience members as well. Always put in a plug. So. Somebody can challenge you, but you have to challenge you way over here, so that's okay. Thank you, and we'll have folks here. If we may have permission with our either PowerPoints or URLs, we can post them on our website so that folks wouldn't have to send out individually. We can certainly facilitate that. And those that can stay around, is it okay if we stay around a little bit and then get you guys off on your way driving south? Thank you.